And Happy New Year, and welcome to Angel Answers. I'm your host, Amy Toy. I am very blessed to be here with all of you today. It's a fantastic 2013. I have a lot of shows lined up, and first being the most exciting, this is a really good author and life coach and everything else he's going to be on. I'll introduce him in just a moment. But, of course, I have to start my announcements. We've got a lot of stuff going on in January. February's booked. March is being worked on. So this is going to be a jam-packed year for everyone. This is I'm very excited. Next week, I have a Course in Miracles author, D. Patrick Miller. He will be discussing his books, Living with Miracles, A Common Sense Guide to A Course in Miracles, and Understanding A Course in Miracles, The History, Message, and Legacy of a Spiritual Path for Today. I've got to slow down here. The week of the 21st, I have Meadow Lynn will be our featured guest regarding her new cookbook, who she co-authored with Hay House author, who happens to be her mother, Denise Lynn. And the book's entitled The Mystic Cookbook, The Secret Alchemy of Food. So she's going to be. And then finally, on the 28th, I have a very special lady coming on who's a very close friend of mine. She's been on our show before, but she is going to be, we'll be doing readings that day. So that's going to be our show for doing free readings. Her name is Betty Ann Marcoux. And, of course, you can find me at angelanswers11.com, and you can email me at angelicamy35@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter at angelanswers11, Facebook Angel Answers with Amy Toy. I have a blog. Just look at the BBS radio host. So without further ado, I have an author that has a revolutionary book out there. His name is Jason Lincoln Jeffers. He is a spiritual teacher, a life and wellness coach. He's a mystical artist, astrologer, entrepreneur, author, and a self-taught authority on metaphysics, transpersonal psychology, and alternative medicine. And his book is out. He's here to discuss it. Welcome, Jason. How are you today?
I'm well, Amy. Thank you so much for having me and allowing me to share the message of my new book with your listening audience.
Yes, your book is very interesting. I mean, it has a lot of things to it that people really feel, because we just got out of the 2012 shift and everyone thought the world was going to end, or some people did. Obviously, we're still here. And,
yeah.
I was thinking about that today, because I was looking over, some of the materials. And you have an awesome book. It's called The Next Human, A Guide to Personal and Collective Evolution, which is a really cool title for a book. So, Jason, though, how did you come to be? How did you get on this path, of this spiritual path? You want to tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'll take it from there?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It began really when I was very young. My father was 65 when I was born.
Oh, wow.
And so he was a spiritual teacher, and so he kind of raised me. By the time I was 6 and 7, I was learning how to interpret my dreams,
mm-hmm.
and meditate. And by the time I was 9, I was learning how to channel. So I had a very unusual upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
But then later, when he passed away, when I was 23, I became very, very depressed. And I was actually going through a divorce at the time that my father passed away, and he suffered from cancer for many years. And so it was very, very stressful and traumatic for me. This is in the late 1980s, 1990, early 1990s. I came down with a very severe case of chronic fatigue syndrome, to the point where it was debilitating. So it kind of forced me inward.
Uh-huh.
And as I went inward, I became very depressed and had a lot of stress and anxiety from the fact that I was very limited as to what I could do. So what I started doing was starting researching and studying and trying to figure out why I was suffering. And so eventually it led to my epiphany that I was creating my own reality. And so that's how we kind of began the book, with that introduction. And also in the first chapter to discovering the pseudo-self, and then takes the reader on a transformational journey, so to speak, what I call the transformation of the seven selves. And so it begins with transcending the ego and understanding what that is, and then the ego shadow, which is the phantom self, which is the pain body, and then the physical self. Of course, I had a number of physical diseases, which I talk about in the book and describe very in very detail how I was able to heal my body from all these diseases. And then the next self is the mirror self, which is about transforming relationships. And so in that chapter, I've written some short stories and about relationships and all the problems and sufferings that we go through in them. And then the next chapter is chapter 5, which is the creative self. And that chapter is about heart-based manifestation and learning how to manifest and create from the heart instead of the brain, which is what the book, The Secret, talks about, manifesting mainly from the mind. And then we teach how to transcend the mind and go into the heart in that chapter. The next chapter is chapter 6, which is the ethereal self, and that talks about the spiritual body and the return of the sacred feminine and the importance of that. And in that chapter, I have a memoir about my personal Kundalini awakening, which I go to in detail. A lot of people are having that now. They don't know what it is. And then the final chapter is chapter 7, and that is the zero-point self, and that is becoming one with the source. And that is, in that chapter, I give a lot of research on quantum physics, how quantum physics is actually catching up to ancient mysticism, and that they are really two sides of the same coin, that science and spirituality are two sides of the same coin. And so that's really the journey, the transformational journey that we go on, and then eventually we become the zero-point self, which is becoming one with the source.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, well, let's go into a little bit of those the terminology that you just threw out to the audience for those who don't, you know, understand some of the pain body and the, you know, and you do talk about, you know, and I did read your book, you know, and that you went through different things very chronologically, which was great, because some people, I think, are, you know, we are evolving as a species. I really do feel that. And so it's great that we have a guide here. So, Jason, what is the most evil? What does that mean? What is the definition of that?
Well, breeding the worst evil is, most people think the evil is, the worst evil is the singular individuals such as the dictator like Hitler or Stalin or in the lone serial killer. But really, evil is the worst evil is when a group, a tribe, or a nation of individuals unite together into a singular ideology. And that ideology becomes so inseparable from the absolute truth that they become one with it, and then they their survival in their mind depends on that ideology. And if somebody threatens their ideology, such as another person or another nation, then they rise up in violence against that other person, tribe, or nation. And that's what we saw in the 20th century. That's the reason why we had 207 wars and 170 million people die violently because of that that group, tribe, or nation identifying so closely with a simple belief or idea that they cannot separate it from their very sense of survival. So that's really the worst evil. It's not the singular you know, person that goes out and maybe, you know, murders 10 or 20 people. It's the groups, the, you know, of people that unite with that ideology. So that in my opinion is the worst evil.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I have an uncle that has passed away, but he was, you know, born in Germany when Hitler, you know, reigned to power. You know, he had a millennial reign which lasted 12 years, and he denied that the Holocaust happened. We would get into arguments with him that, you know, it was amazing. I was like, are you kidding me? It said 6 million Jews and, you know, outcasts were killed, and you're arguing this point. So it's amazing. My father and him almost got into a fist fight over it one time. It was really...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so, you know, I see where you're, you know, that ideology of Hitler even, you know, even coming back, and, you know, that was back in the early 80s, you know, when this was going on with him, so... I don't know. You just brought that to my mind. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go off topic, but that they just brought
me
back.
No, that's a very good example of how powerful that identification with a particular belief is. And what I stress in that chapter, in that first chapter, the pseudo self, is that we really have to get beyond that. We are more than our beliefs. We are more than identifying with a belief or an opinion. And so that cherishing of opinions is why people argue, why people fight, and why the ego says, because you and I disagree, you are my enemy. And to the next human, that's insanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why people fight, people argue, we have conflicts, and why we have wars.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it boils down to.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger of all that. I mean, it's just, it's amazing. I don't know why that example. So, you know, you mentioned the ego. How can we transcend the ego? I mean, I don't know if we can deny it, but how do we transcend it? You know, how do we get
it? Well, we transcend it by identifying the ego, not identifying with it. If you're identified with it, which is what most people are, then you and the ego are one. It's inseparable from you. That's who you feel yourself to be.
Mm-hmm.
So the ego, and for the ego to remain, and for you to remain ego-identified, then the ego will always perceive the other as either inferior or superior in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates a polarity. Okay, that creates separation from you and the other. And that's the reason why we have the current political arena so polarized and has been for the last decade, 12 years in America. And it's why we have all these wars and nations that are opposed, is because of that egoic identification. We haven't learned yet as a species to separate our true self from the ego. And so until we do that, until we create a space in between that egoic self and our true eternal self or higher self or zero-point self, we are going to continue to have wars as it will be perpetuating, and we may not make it as a species. We may just wipe ourselves out. We have 17,000 nuclear warheads on the planet, and 4,000 are armed and ready. So... We just can't keep going on like this. So, when you transcend the ego, I teach you and I give you the tools in that chapter to identify the ego in yourself and in others. And it's a process. It takes time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like anything. You know, just when you first got on a bike when you were a child, you didn't just start riding it. You had to learn how to ride it. That's why you get training wheels, and eventually you fall down. And so. It takes time and practice, but eventually you'll recognize the ego before it comes out, and you recognize it in others, and then it becomes really kind of ridiculous when you turn on the news and see how everybody is completely identified with their ego, except for, you know, the light workers and spiritual teachers of the world and the spiritually centered people, which are heart-centered. And this is the next human. This is the next human stage when we can learn how to transcend it. And so in that chapter, I give you all the tools to do that.
Yes, you do. It's a very, yes, because sometimes, you know, there's different teachings about the ego. Some teachings say deny it, some say transcend it. You know, it all depends. But, yes, I believe the ego is, well, what does it really mean, edging God out? So, or sort of.
It's edging God out. Well, yes, of course. But I also stress that the ego is neither your friend nor the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at it upon the enemy, in other words, if you say we have to get rid of it, we have to suppress it, we have to deny it, then you are, that's the embodiment of ego. You are still ego-identified because the ego creates an enemy. That's what the ego does. It needs that adversary to exist. Okay, it thrives on it. And so you're still lost, trapped in the egoic mind. Conversely, if you believe that you have to befriend the ego, you know, keep the good parts of it, which there are really none. The good parts
are all
coming from the heart. If you, all the good parts of humanity comes from the heart. It's when we are able to remove ourselves from the ego. So if you still feel that the ego needs to be your friend, then you're still trapped in the ego. So you have to really just look at it neutrally, and just identify it, see it for what it is, and then a space will develop. It'll be slow at first, but then it'll expand and become larger, and eventually you'll be able to separate yourself, your true self, from that ego, and you won't be living in that egoic state anymore. You'll be living in the heart, and so that's where the next human is. She lives in the heart.
Yes, definitely agree with that. So, what is the phantom self? That's an interesting little.
Well, the phantom self is simply the shadow of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
It's what Carl Jung called the shadow, and it's what Eckhart Tolle calls the pain body, and it's what we project onto others in the form of judgment, condemnation, criticism, and intolerance. And when we get angry or when we hate others in any way, it's all those negative, dark emotions projected onto others. But we're not aware that we're doing it because we're really suppressing all those dark emotions in ourselves. That's what we're afraid of. At some point in our childhood, we were all wounded in some way. We became hurt. And when that happened, that became the beginning of our phantom self because we tried to create a cloak, a mask, as it were, to hide these dark emotions and these dark feelings and these fears that we are somehow inferior to someone else. So we grow up trying to make others feel inferior to compensate for that. So the people who are pointing fingers at everybody, who are harsh on other people, who are constantly criticizing them, condemning them, judging them, they have the worst fears. Because otherwise they wouldn't be projecting all of that dark energy onto others. So in reality, they're the ones that are really hurt the most, and they're trying to constantly compensate for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the phantom, and that pain body energy is manifested in the physical body, and eventually if you deny it and suppress it for long enough, you become addicted to food or alcohol or drugs or gambling or you know, cheating on your spouse or whatever it is, these addictions that we see out there in the public all the time, is really side effects or symptoms of the phantom self, which is your unknown face.
Interesting. Yes, I can relate to that. You know. Got a few relatives there too. Not trying to judge them.
But everybody does. Everybody has, you know, somebody in the family who really is a prime example of that phantom self. I know I certainly do, and friends and past relationships. But it's really really identify again, just like with the ego, you have to, you know, identify it in yourself and in others when it comes out. And so in that chapter on the phantom self, I teach how you can do that, give a lot of tools on how to do that. And that's where we get bullying. We get all this bullying epidemic now, all these kids staying home, hundreds of thousands of kids stay home every day because of bullying. And it's just getting, you know, worse and worse. And that's the phantom, because this bullying energy most of these bullies have been abused in some way and have been hurt, and so they're compensating for that and taking that very painful, hurtful energy out on others. Mm-hmm. And at the same token, you have the phantom prey. The bully would be the phantom predator. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of the coin, you have the phantom prey. And the phantom prey is an individual who plays the victim in life, mm-hmm. unconsciously, just like the bully plays the predator unconsciously. So you can't really have one without the other. And that's why the bullies always seek out the victims. The predators always seek out the prey in the same way that a fox seeks out a rabbit, because you can smell it 100 yards away. And so it's that frequency, that vibration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I went through that. I was bullied every year in school from the second grade all the way into high school, physically and verbally. So the reason why, I was abused by my stepfather. He abused me very harshly when I was between the ages of 6 and 10. So that was my model of the world, that it's okay to be physically violent, that physical violence is accepted. And so I became very angry and toward others, and everybody became, you know, my enemy, so to speak. I became afraid. And so that fear and anger, which are your dark emotions, gets picked up. And I was always physically smaller because I skipped first grade, so I was usually a year and a half to 2 years younger than my classmates. And being a boy, that's not a good thing, so because you get picked on a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I had the opposite problem. I was too tall. I was always the tall one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and yeah, they call me like these, you know, mega mama or something, you know, because I'm so tall. And, you know, I'm like 5'8", so I don't think I'm that tall. My mother's 5'10", you know, so it's amazing how people just, you're physically not, you know. So, yeah, so Jason, what is the difference between a passive pain body and an aggressive pain body? That's an interesting, that I know about the pain body, but I didn't know there was different distinctions there.
Right. Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The phantom predator is the aggressive pain body.
Okay.
And the phantom prey is the passive pain body. So the aggressive pain body is you know, the predator that goes around beating up other people. usually it's the male in our species. But the passive pain body or the phantom prey will, you know, typically be a female, but not always. I've seen a lot of female predators that are bullies into other people, especially if they get into positions of authority,
mm-hmm.
where they are able to get away with it. That happens somewhat frequently, but especially in the workplace, which I talk about the next chapter, which is chapter 4, where I talk about relationships. I talk about the abusive boss. There's a lot of people get abused in some way by their boss, because what happens is when somebody gets appointed or promoted to a position of authority, then it goes right to their head, which is the ego.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the ego seeks. That's the prime directive of the ego. It ultimately seeks power, specifically power over the other. Okay? So that is that the aggressiveness, and that's in the worst case scenario, you find these are people who are seeking power on the political arena in government, and in also in business, and also on Wall Street, right, in banks, and the ego goes to their head, and they seek this power, and so then their actions become completely unconscious, and they become very oppressive. And this is what is going on today in a government, in all of the governments of the world, really. Especially here in America, where we have this polarization. But yeah, so that's really what the difference is between the two pain bodies.
And so how do you dissolve that pain body? How do you, work with it or dissolve it?
Well, you have to first identify it in yourself and in others, and so I teach in that chapter how you do that. Once you can do that successfully, then there's a process of healing, and that process doesn't happen overnight. It took me many years, but once I finally understood that there was such a thing and that I was really creating my own pain, it seemed that the pain body is also an addiction to pain. In both the prey and the predator. So it's an addiction to feeding on the pain. So really, the person simply becomes the host because it's a pain parasite, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in the predator, it feeds on the pain that it inflicts on other people. So it's like a vampiric entity, right, sucking the blood, so to speak, from others, in sucking the pain from others. And then in the victim, that the pain body feeds on the pain received, see, and so it keeps going back. That's why you have people that keep going back into relationships, even though they keep getting abused by their partner,
mm-hmm.
and it seems crazy, but they keep returning to that partner, and that's the reason, is because it's an addiction to the pain. They must go back to the pain body, because they are so identified with their own pain body, they haven't created a space in between it. That pain body has control over them, and has consumed them to the point where all of their actions are unconscious. And so they go back into the same relationship over and over again, even though they continue to be abused over and over again. So in order to transcend it, you have to first see that and see that pain. And then it manifests, especially in the phantom prey, it manifests into physical disease, as it did with me. I eventually, came down with chronic fatigue syndrome. My marriage was so tumultuous. We were married for 2.5 years and lived together 8 months, and 6 of them were miserable. So I was addicted to pain in relationships because, again, until you can transcend it, you're going to keep attracting the same type of partner into your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it will keep repeating itself. It's just the way the universe works, and it will get worse every time
mm-hmm.
Until you wake up. Because mm-hmm. the reason for that is you're more likely to wake up from a nightmare than you are from a pleasant dream. If you're
mm-hmm.
having a pleasant dream, you want to keep on dreaming.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you don't want to go there. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And so the people that are really suffering the most are the ones that are about to wake up, and these are the burgeoning next humans.
Mm.
See? Because they've reached a point in their life where they simply can't take it anymore, and that's where I was. I was looked upon everybody as insane,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't believe the way that they were acting, and Then I started to realize eventually that it was all a mirror of me, that I was, because I was projecting my anger and hatred toward them, the universe projected that same back to me. Because that's the law of attraction. You
mm-hmm.
You are who you attract in relationships, and that's the way mm-hmm. it works. And so if you're projecting all these dark negative emotions and seething anger and hatred out toward others in the world, then the universe can only reflect, because the universe is really a mirror of yourself. And so that's what I teach in the mirror self chapter. That and then there's the collective mirror, which is everybody, the hive mind, the group consciousness, and that collective mirrors what the 7 billion souls are projecting upon it. As the analogy I give is, it's like it's a movie screen, and that movie screen can only show us what the projector is projecting on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
right.
That's what we see in the world. That's what we see when we turn on the television, on the news. all of that, and you know, all the hurricanes, the tsunamis, the tornadoes, the wars, the conflicts, the impoverishment, and all these social injustices that go on, it's all a reflection of ourselves projecting out the judgment and the hatred and the anger and the blame onto others, because it can only show us what we are projecting on it. It all stems from us. And so when we right. when we transcend all of these dark emotions, that's when we see a shift in our reality. That's when we see a shift on the world stage, our collective mirror. It cannot happen until then.
Exactly. You have to reach that point of pain. Like you said, I like that analogy about waking up from the nightmare. I like that. I'm going to use that with my clients, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I like that, you know, because they call you with the same issue. Yeah, so, yeah, that's a good analogy, Jason. I like that.
Yes.
What is our unknown sugar addiction? I thought that was an interesting, because I've heard about this here, bits and pieces from other people. What is our unknown sugar addiction?
Right. Well, the unknown sugar addiction is... America is a good example, because we are the worst country by far than any other nation when it comes to sugar. The average American consumes about a wheelbarrow full of sugar a year.
Wow.
And that has escalated from just 200 years ago, where it was just, you know, a sugar bag full or whatever. It was very small compared to what we consume now. And that's mainly because of the industrialization of agriculture and the processing of foods and so forth, and putting this high fructose corn syrup in all of our foods. So when you buy foods from the supermarket, if you're not looking on the labels, you'll notice that about 80% of the foods you buy have sugar in them to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where most of the sugar comes from. But then I cut all that out years ago, but I still couldn't get well, even though I wasn't eating processed sugar. Because the unknown sugar addiction is in the fruit juices and in the high glycemic index starchy foods such as white rice, white potatoes,
mm-hmm.
corn, pasta, and all of your cereals, your breads, and so forth. Because, I mean, just two slices of whole wheat bread are the equivalent of consuming two tablespoons full of white sugar to your body. Your body cannot tell the difference, because what happens in the body is it converts it all into glucose. If it's sucrose, fructose from fruit, doesn't matter, galactose from navy beans, it doesn't matter. That all of that starch gets converted into glucose so that the body can burn it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it can't burn it, then it has to produce insulin from the pancreas.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, over time, the insulin becomes toxic to the cell, because you're constantly consuming sugar or starchy foods. And all of this, you know, pasta and starchy foods and orange juice and whatnot that you're consuming every day. I was eating, putting organic honey and organic maple syrup on my cereal every morning, unknown to the fact that all of that gets converted into sugar in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until I learned that sugar is sugar is sugar to the body that I changed my diet, and I went to a low glycemic index diet. I was borderline type 2 diabetes. I had hypoglycemia, very severe, and I was very fatigued all the time. So when I learned that, within just a few months of this new ketogenic diet that I talk about in the book, my energy went through the roof. I was able to start running again, and my energy increased dramatically, and I became more clear-minded. And so it really had a tremendous effect on me. So I knew that it was my systemic candida went away. It was this whole yeast syndrome that we have out there that people have, all that dissipated and dissolved because yeast feeds on sugar. And so does cancer cells feed on sugar because they're anaerobic. And so I think it's 97% of all cancer patients also have candida. They also have that fungus. And so a lot of this sugar doesn't get processed because sugar is very toxic and poisonous to the body. We're not really designed to run on sugar. The body doesn't prefer glucose. It prefers ketones.
Mm-hmm.
And ketones are the energy units found in fat. And this is what your brain prefers to run on, which is what your heart prefers to run on. And so when you're able to change the diet, get rid of the starchy foods, get rid of the sugar, then your body automatically starts to run on ketones. And when it does, you have a lot more energy. You don't have to eat so often. That's why most people get hungry 2 to 3 hours after they eat. And so what do? They reach for a Starbucks cafe latte, right? Or they go out to smoke a cigarette, reach for tea, drink a glass of tea, which has caffeine, and that caffeine helps to replace the sugar intake because it really has a similar effect on the body in that it really creates a surge of this hormone called leptin, which I talk about in detail, and that is the king of all hormones. And we're just learning more about leptin every day. It's the new hormone that they discovered back in the 90s, and they realized that it controlled all the other hormones in the body. And so until you can control leptin, if your leptin is imbalanced, then all your other hormones are going to be imbalanced, see? And this is why people have depression. This is why people have anxiety, because their hormones are completely out of whack.
Yeah, exactly. There were some women with PMS. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So this ketogenic diet, we talked about the benefits. So what is it exactly? Is it? It's just cutting out, I've been cutting out my sugars. I've been watching my sugar intake, and I do notice a difference already. What else is with the ketogenic diet here that you're talking about?
Well, the ketogenic diet is simply allowing your body to run on ketones. We've been running on ketones for the past 2 million years. It's only been in the past 10,000 years since the beginning of agriculture where Homo sapiens have been running on glucose, at least intermittently. A lot of humans were still running on ketones if they adhered to a proper diet, but in the last 100 years, because of the industrialization of agriculture and the processing of foods and the adding this high fructose corn syrup to our diet, then we have really become addicted to sugar in a big way, and it's just as addictive as caffeine or nicotine or heroin. Your body just becomes physically addicted to it, and it's very, very difficult for a lot of people to get off of it. So it's a healthier way to live in a lot of ways because you don't have to consume as many calories. So it's a more of a low caloric intake diet, and then because you're getting the ketones from fat, and I go into the healthy fats, we've been taught the wrong things about fat in America. Most of the rest of the world understands that saturated fats are important for the body, that you need that. But I mean, in America, we don't understand that at all, and so we are really here because we're taught that all saturated fat is bad for you. We don't eat enough of it, and you really need cholesterol. Cholesterol is important. Your brain is made mostly of cholesterol, see? And your body absolutely needs cholesterol more than anything, especially for the liver. And so if we don't get enough of it, then then the body starts to create its own cholesterol, and that's when we get the arterial plaque.
Okay.
So we need the dietary cholesterol so that the body doesn't have to replace it. The liver can, it has the ability to do so, but only in a famine emergency. That's why cholesterol is so if cholesterol weren't so important to the body, why does the body have a backup mechanism to temporarily manufacture it?
Mm-hmm.
But it's only supposed to be temporary. We're supposed to be taking it in from the from our diet. And the only way to do that is from fats, healthy fats. Now, the unhealthy fats are the monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats, like the vegetable oil fats, your canola oil, and your other oils that are hydrogenated. Okay, so if they're hydrogenated or in any way, then they are the most dangerous of fats, and then they're the ones that cause that arterial plaque and that are dangerous to the body, and they are what we were being taught as the healthy fats, you know, corn oil and soybean oil. I mean, it's poisonous because these are trans fats. The body doesn't know what to do with them. Because they're artificially processed. And so when you take anything artificial into the body identifies it as poison. That's why genetically modified foods are hurting a lot of people, and we're finally realizing that because the body's more intelligent than we are, and when we learn to honor it and you take in things that are natural, then we won't have the diseases that we have today. It's because we keep trying to force the body to take in these unnatural foods. I mean, if you put a mixture of gasoline and seawater in your car's engine, how far do you think it would run?
Not
right?
Far.
And yet this is what we're doing to the body. And this is why disease has escalated. This is why we have all these epidemic diseases, because we're not taught the right diet. The right way to eat. And a lot of countries that are the healthiest nations on earth, such as Japan and especially the island of Okinawa off Japan, they eat a fair ketogenic diet. They eat the carbs that they intake are low glycemic intake. The Okinawans, they don't eat white potatoes. They eat sweet potatoes. And sweet potatoes are not even related to the white potatoes. It's a different species of potato altogether, and they have a much lower glycemic index. And plus, they're nutrient dense. In fact, they're the most nutrient dense food on the planet, ounce for ounce. There's more nutrients in a sweet potato in all the varieties than in any other food, any other plant food. So when we learn the right foods to eat, the superfoods, you know, such as the hot peppers and garlic and all your vegetables, your broccoli, your Brussels sprouts, your cabbage, and we get off of this starch-based diet, most people just live on starch, they take in very few nutrients, then we're going to see a downturn in the diseases that we have, and we won't have to rely on these prescription drugs, which do nothing really but relieve some of the symptoms. But at the same token, it's really kind of a wash because they create side effects that sometimes are worse than the symptoms of the disease itself.
I agree. Oh, yes, I agree with that. Yes, definitely. Yeah, it's amazing. It's totally amazing. I mean, I look at my parents and they're like, my father's got like 14 medications, you know, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, what are you doing here? But that's another story, you know, that's his life, you know. I think God learned from his past, so... You recovered from chronic fatigue syndrome. I have a very good friend of mine that has that. How did you do that, Jason? That's amazing. You recovered from that.
Well, it was a process, and even though I give all the healing modalities in that chapter that I did, I clearly state at the beginning of the chapter that I couldn't get to that state until I first was able to heal the mind, which is the ego, and transcend that ego. and start living in the heart. And once I was able to do that, and then the stress and anxiety started to be relieved, and then the body was freed up, and then I was able to attract to me the right healing modalities. And many of those modalities, all of those modalities are gone into great detail in that chapter. I had mercury toxicity from all the fillings that I had put in my mouth when I was a child. Mm. And so I naturally detoxified all of that with an infrared sauna. Mm-hmm. And I was so thrilled with that, I created a company called Sunlighten, and now it's one of the fastest growing holistic wellness companies in the country, and you know, we sell thousands of infrared saunas around the world. So that's a natural way of detoxifying. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning stage. That began back in the early 2000s, and then the next step was the chiropractic, and then I had a very severe subluxation, which is an imbalance in your C1 and C2 vertebrae. And the C1 houses the brain stem, and the brain stem controls the nerve function, all the nervous system. And if there's an imbalance there, or impingement, or interference, then that also can have effect on your health and lower your immune system. So I had dizziness all the time. I was chronically dizzy because of an inner ear disorder. And that was all caused by that subluxation due to two car accidents I had when I was a teenager from whiplash. And okay. So if you have any trauma to that area, then you most likely have a subluxation to your spine. And mm-hmm. Now the upper cervical care that I started to receive, it's a very small percentage of chiropractic care. It's only about 3-5% of chiropractors are upper cervical. Mm-hmm. So you have to find an upper cervical practitioner. Not all mm-hmm. chiropractors are that way. And then the third and final way I was able to cure the systemic candida and get all my energy back was through the ketogenic diet. So it was really those three things that process, and that took a period of about 10 years.
Okay, yeah, that was interesting because, like I said, I have a very good friend of mine that has that issue. And mm-hmm. So that would be good. We're going to jump a little bit to what is heart-based manifestation? What does that mean?
Well, heart-based manifestation is different from mind-based in that you are creating from heart. The book The Secret talks about mind-based manifestation, but the brain, when you manifest from the mind or the brain, it's you're manifesting a polarized reality because the brain is polarized. It has two hemispheres, right and left. And so whatever you do manifest, I mean, you may get the mansion and Mercedes, but you also get a great deal of stress and drama and conflict and everything you don't want right along with it. And that's kind of yeah. what happened with me when I created my business, and I certainly wasn't manifesting from the heart. And so I got a lot of that along with the business. And so it wasn't in the beginning, but it wasn't worth it. I realized that it just wasn't worth it, and that's when I learned about heart-based. But heart-based manifestation, it's a seven-stage process, and the first stage is to first be present, because the ego cannot exist in presence. In when you're present, the ego is taken out of the equation, and that's the first element in heart-based manifestation. If your mind is constantly going, then you're not going to be open to the next stage, which is imaging or imagining or envisioning your idea. Mm-hmm. And so you will probably go through a period of failing where you try to create something, you fail, try to create something else, fail. But when you're present, it usually comes to you ready-made, the yeah. right idea. So you're able to manifest it the first time around. You don't have to go through all the the stages of failure. And then the third element to the equation is belief. You have to believe in your idea. And it's the most powerful creative tool that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So without belief, really nothing can be manifested. So you have to have faith, you have to have trust, and you have to have surrender. And when you surrender, then you're going into the heart. And that's acceptance. It's a source of unconditional love, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fourth stage is passion and excitement for your idea. And when you have this passion, then you are able to you're communicating to the universe that you are really believing your idea, that you are really enthusiastic, and that's very powerful in the manifestation process. The fifth part of the equation is focused action. So you really have to become focused. A laser-like focus on what you want is
mm-hmm.
very crucial. Anybody who's manifested anything has been really focused,
mm-hmm.
anything successful, that is,
mm-hmm.
has been really focused on what they're doing, and they have blinders on. They're not dissuaded by other people. A lot of people will try to dissuade you or throw in negativity,
mm-hmm.
put you down and say, yeah, this is not going to work. This, you know, what are you doing? Which this is what they did to me when,
mm-hmm.
when I first started my business.
Yep.
But
mm-hmm.
I stayed focused, and that's very necessary. The sixth part of the equation is persistence. A lot of people give up, and
mm-hmm.
that's why they fail. And that's the only time that you fail is when you give up. If you really believe in what you're doing and are persistent, then it will become a success. And then the final seventh part of the equation is gratitude. You have to be grateful for everything that is happening, no matter what you are given and no matter how little it may seem to you at the time or how negative it may seem at the time. Always be grateful. I mean, if you're living in the woods in a shack and you're riding a bicycle to work, be grateful for that, and then the universe will give you more. That's just the way it works, because the universe can only reward through love, and it reflects, and gratitude is love. It's really reflecting that love back to you and by rewarding you. So that's the law of heart-based manifestation, and I go to it in much more detail in that chapter.
Mm-hmm. And we're running a little short of time, but I want to get into what is a kundalini awakening. That's interesting. I love working with kundalini energy.
Okay. Well, kundalini, simply means she who is coiled, and it's life force energy
mm-hmm.
that is... lies dormant in most human beings at the base of the spine, coiled around the coccyx bone.
Okay.
Exactly 3.5 times. And when she is awakened, she starts to rise up the spine. And
mm-hmm.
as she does, she, you know, she opens up the chakras, which are the
mm-hmm.
vortices or energy centers of the ethereal body.
Mm-hmm.
And as she does this, it creates a divine bliss. It creates what a lot of people who have had out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences have felt.
Mm-hmm.
When we enter this ethereal realm,
mm-hmm.
We feel this wonderful divine bliss. And
uh-huh.
so the kundalini awakening is really an inner body experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and a lot of people are having that now that we've moved past the end of the Mayan calendar, and we're, you know, this shift in consciousness is taking place. I believe that in the next few years we'll have millions of people that will have a kundalini awakening. And eventually she when she travels up and opens up all the seven chakras, she reaches the crown chakra at the top of the head, and that's when the initiate receives enlightenment, or what's also called self-realization,
mm-hmm.
and that is that we are all one,
mm-hmm.
and that we are of one mind, and we are unified consciousness. So that has gone into detail in that chapter. I write a memoir and go to it in pretty much detail so that people can understand and identify. People who have gone through it or are about to go through it or are going through it can understand what the symptoms of it are. And it's a very powerful experience because that's when you realize that you are much more than this temporal physical body.
Right.
You're much greater than that.
Yes. I totally get where you're coming from. I had two near-death experiences, so I totally
get that.
Yeah, so you
understand.
You do. Yeah, it's really an awesome awakening. Well, our time is cutting short. I love this topic. We could have gone on for hours. It was a great show. Where can people find you, your book? Because I know you do some coaching too, spiritual coaching or life coaching, correct? Where can people find you, Jason? You're a great guy.
They can find me on my site, which is jasonlincolnjeffers.com. Mm-hmm. And if they want some coaching or counseling, they can sign up for it there. And also the book is available there in three different formats, so they can buy the book. And also I have art, what I call mystical expressionism, available on my website. And I also do life path astrology readings. So if they are interested in astrology, a reading to learn their life path, or if they want their transits done, if they want to know where they're going in the next few years, I can do a transit reading, which is predictive astrology, or I also do compatibility astrology. So I do all three modalities of astrology. I've been doing that since I was in my teens.
Wow, that's great. Jason, thank you for coming on the show today. This was a great show. Thank you so much for your knowledge, and definitely we'll get your book out there as much as we can. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Amy, for having me on your show. It's been a delight to speak with you today.
Thank you. Have a great day. And everyone, have a great day. May the angels carry you through. Bye-bye.